All right, everybody, it's about 1 o'clock here, and I'm just going to get started as the recording has been started as well. On behalf of the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, welcome to today's training, Optimizing Injection Strategies and In-Situ Remediation Performance. My name is Devin Setchkar. I'm your moderator today from Arlington, Virginia. For a CE, today's class includes continuing education units, or also known as CEUs. If you'd like to receive 2 CEUs for this training, please register and pay through ITRC's Wild Apricot portal. I will put the link in the chat here to everybody. I'm also going to cover a few housekeeping rules for today so that you know how you can actively participate. So like I said before, this training is an introduction to the associated online guidance document noted on this slide, Optimizing Injection Strategies and In-Situ Remediation Performance. This guidance document was produced by ITRC in 2019. We cannot cover all of the information, tools, and resources available in this guidance document today, so please visit our website and take a look at the document if you have not already done so. We hope that it will be a resource for you while you work on your environmental sites. I will also put the link to the online guidance document in the chat here. So today's training is sponsored by the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, also known as ITRC, and is hosted by the U.S. EPA Cleanup Information Network, also known as CLUIN. So some housekeeping rules. I'm sure if you're familiar with our training courses, you've heard these before, but I'm just going to run through them quickly for our new participants. Today's training is scheduled for about 2 hours and 15 minutes. As I mentioned, this training is being recorded and will be available on demand for those not able to make it today. Trainers will be in control of the slides as we move through today's training session. If you'd like to control your own slides, you're able to download the training slides from the initial training page that directed you to Zoom here today. I'd also just like to note that while we are in Zoom, any links that are in the PowerPoint that is being shown are not active. So if you would like to, you know, access those live links, please download the PowerPoint PDF from the CLUIN training page that brought you here. There in Zoom, you have access to a Q&A window where you can ask questions or report technical issues at any time. We will have 2 Q&A breaks during this training, and we'll get to as many questions as we can verbally. If we have too many questions to answer out loud, we will ask our trainers to respond directly back to that person through our Zoom webinar Q&A window. There is an online feedback form available for completion at the end of the training today. By completing this feedback form, you are eligible to receive a certificate of completion for today's training course by checking the box that you to certify that you participated. And then after you complete and submit the feedback form, a certificate will be sent to you via email. The Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council is a program of the Environmental Council of States. We are a state-led organization composed of over 1,000 members from state agencies, federal government, the private sector, academia, and community stakeholders. Our members participate in technical teams which produce tools, resources, and training courses such as the one you're participating on today. If you would like to become a part of ITRC, please visit our website or feel free to contact us directly. On our website, you can register for teams and learn more about how you can become an active member. The full ITRC disclaimer is available on the ITRC website. If you do plan to use any ITRC materials, we ask that you review that policy in detail and be sure to credit ITRC accordingly. ITRC is partially funded by the U.S. government. ITRC nor the U.S. government warranty the material nor endorse any specific products. On slide 5, I have the pleasure of introducing our expert trainers today. All of them have been active members of ITRC's Optimizing Injection Strategies and In-Situ Remediation Performance Team over the years. Not only do they serve as volunteer trainers for ITRC, but they have dedicated many hours to developing this guidance document and training. Special thank you to all of them for participating today. Our trainers here are listed on this slide, and I'm very grateful that they could join us today. If you'd like to read more about their expertise, you can access their bios at the link at the bottom of the page, which is also the link that brought you here today, the CLUIN training page. So if you would like to read more about them, I encourage you to visit that training page and check out their bios. So with that, I am going to pass it off to Christopher McCandless from the Virginia Department of Environmental Quality.
And thank you very much, Devin, and thank you all for attending this webinar. Could you please open the first poll question there, Devin? All right, as it says, have you ever had a remedy not meet design expectations? All right, as you answer this, I just want to tell you that this opening slide gives you the online web address for the document. And because in the last 10 years, all of ITRC's documents have been web-based. So this is no exception. And this is actually a stellar case for it because we have a lot of links that are web-based here. So, all right. So you're in the right place for the next 2 hours if you said yes to the poll question. And it looks like 94% have said yes. Good. 6% no. Okay. For the people that said no, we'd like to know your secret, because a lot of us have spent a couple of years on this document, you know, would like to know that. Anyway, as our first slide implies, this, you can take that down. Oh, thank you. Let's see now, working on band here, trying to advance. I guess I've lost it. Arrow key's not working. Oh yeah, it is. Is it? Devin, did you do that or did I do that?
You did that. I think it's working for you.
Okay. Okay, good. Good. Sorry about that. Okay. So as the first slide implies, this webinar is aimed for your site involving the injection of amendments at the correct dosages for in situ remediation of contaminant mass and how to optimize that process. Although the subject of in situ remediation is not as far from new, everyone, even the ones who said no to the poll question, have encountered challenges when it comes to in situ remediation. All right, trying to advance. Let me try this again. I'm not seeing the advancement there, Devin, so I guess I'm going to need you to do it. Thank you. All right. The problem we are facing is failing to achieve the expected objectives or performances of in situ remedies in encountering unknown variables that impact the effectiveness. So be thinking of your own examples, and Rich will touch on some of those in the next segment. Okay, next. Our team did a survey of state regulators across the United States for remediation proposals that they received, and about 40% deemed the first submittal as incomplete. Why? Well, it hinged around an incomplete conceptual site model, CSM, which in turn led to, for example, to inadequate amendment placement or choosing the wrong delivery for the site geology. Next. So what is optimization? Optimization is the effort at any cleanup phase to identify and implement actions that improve effectiveness and cost efficiency of that phase. Now that quote is from the ITRC's 2016 Geospatial Analysis for Optimization. Optimizing in situ remediation is the management of risks and uncertainties through sound science and engineering during different stages of in-situ remediation planning and implementation. I hope you can all see from this webinar and the document we intend to promote the best practices for the benefit of all, the regulatory agencies, the responsible parties, consultants, and the public. Okay, hold on a sec. There we go. Now I got it back. Good deal. All right, so I want you to think of this document and it's all its tables and its fact sheets as an optimization toolbox. On the left is your first introduction to the layout of this guidance. And on the right are the tools we are going to use to optimize the remedial process. We want to make it clear that we wrote this document for remediation managers, responsible parties, and regulators. We did not write this document as a remediation 101. So you need to be familiar with the principles of in situ remediation and preparation of a CSM. We also wrote this document for state regulators, like me, to identify potential shortcomings in remediation plans and to ask specific questions of the consultants and responsible parties. Perhaps you've written a good CSM, felt pretty confident about your remedy selection, but you want to make sure there are no data gaps and that your amendments will work with the selected delivery method. So let's get into this. What are the technical challenges you are encountering with an existing remedy and its implementation? Let me throw out a few scenarios and see if this might be happening at your site. Are we having higher concentrations after injections compared to baseline? Or is there no indication of change after an amendment delivery injection? Do you have insufficient amendment distribution and contact at your site? Is your amendment daylighting? Or are you using the vendor's dosing default values instead of the data from your CSM? All right. With these challenges in mind, let's head over to table 1.1 in Appendix B of the guidance. This slide is a snapshot of commonly encountered issues associated with remedial design characterization. This is one of three sections in this table, the other two being commonly encountered issues with amendment dose and delivery and commonly encountered issues with field implementation. Now, please don't try to read this gray print because this is part of the text, but basically I wanted to point your attention to the column headings. As you identify your lithology or soil type or bedrock type and contaminant, which are the left two columns, you can read the common challenges, lessons learned, and get answers via the fourth column, which contains links to the content within the text, links to particular delivery or amendment fact sheet, and links to other documents, including applicable ITRC guidance as shown here. I want you to think of this table as your custom table of contents, tailored to your particular site conditions or the challenges that you are facing. All right, so this is going to be the layout of our internet-based training today, session today. So think about these items as we move through these introductory slides. This presentation roadmap introduces the three major elements of our key graphic on the left. If you consider the top and bottom boxes as the bread of a sandwich, the lettuce, tomato, and meat of the middle three correlate to the order that the document is written in. So Rich is going to cover remedial design characterization, and then Suzanne is going to cover amendment dose and delivery design, and then Elizabeth will follow up with implementation, monitoring, and interpretation, and then at the end, I will pick up regulatory and stakeholder considerations. Okay, so this flow chart on the left is likely familiar to most of you because it's a CERCLA process of remediating sites and taking them to closure, which is similar to the RCRA process for petroleum impacted sites. But the common goal for both is to clean up sites, right? All right, as we have developed this guidance document, we realized that the linear approach on the left gave us no flexibility. So our key graphic was born, and that is at what you see on the right side of your screen there with the two hexagons in the circle. Can you see the difference simply in the arrows connecting both diagrams, left and right? We realized that optimization was the outcome of better characterizing our subsurface conditions, improving the CSM, performing bench tests and pilot tests, making mistakes, and then going back to an early step, i.e. the double-headed arrows. We realized the most flexible approach had to be iterative. So we're not throwing away the graphic to the left. We are just augmenting it by placing our key graphic in place of these two steps between remedial design and remedial action. And guess what? The iterative approach is nothing new. Our key graphic is an augmentation of ITRC's 11-year-old integrated Dean Apple site strategy guidance, augment to the left. So you can see where the tan, how it fits into this flowchart from that older guidance. Looking at the key graphic a little more closely here, we see again that iterative nature of in-situ remediation. So it's the approach lets the CSM become adaptive to new technologies and new contaminants. The team further augmented the key graphic with what we call the optimization staircase to the right of the key graphic, wherein the process of implementing, monitoring, and optimization takes place during the bench test and pilot test phases of design, section 3, and again during the actual full-scale implementation. Do you see the opportunities for optimization where in the feedback loops of the optimization staircase take you back to the miniature design wheel if, for instance, monitoring implementation didn't work? All right, there's an intro to the key graphic, and now we're going to get into our first hexagon, which is remedial design characterization with Rich DeRozier of GZA Geoenvironmental. Rich?
Thank you, Chris, and good afternoon, everybody. As Chris mentioned, this is a pretty exciting document in terms of aiding in terms of remedial design. And I know I'll give some information in terms of design characterization, and Elizabeth and Suzanne will give more details in terms of the document itself. But in the section in the toolbox area that we have is RDC. Remedial design characterization. What is it and why do we really need it? And what it is the collection of additional data above and beyond general site characterization necessary to develop a sufficiently detailed CMS. And you're all thinking, well, we've done that through our phase 2 and our phase 3 investigations, and we have all the information necessary. I think if you sit back and look at some of the graphics and some of the case studies we'll have, and you'll find out that perhaps phase 2s and phase 3s don't provide sufficient detail for remedial design characterization. And it really enables the designer to be successful for in-situ remedies. So if we look at I'm sorry, just skip a slide here. So why do we want to do RDC? And again, is a lot of the in-situ remedies fail or produce less than an optimal outcome is often due to the lack of detail. And I think the majority of people in the first polling question that Chris had answered the fact that they've went out and they've done a remedy and they've had to go back out and do something else. And a lot of that something else happens to be additional characterization. So really, the characterization is really the hinge on the success of in-situ remedies related directly to the understanding of the site and subsurface conditions. So let's take a look at what the impacts would be. So here's a site that's, you know, was initially characterized, and you can sort of see the color code, the gray being low permeable, medium being the light green, and highly permeable soils being the dark green. We're in alluvial formations with 7 borings spaced about 140 feet apart. The alignment here is about 3,500 feet, and the soils were logged every 5 feet, sort of going out with a hollow stemmed auger sampling, you know, the old traditional way of doing high resolution site characterization. However, today we tend to go out and collect more data. So here we have 40 borings over the same 3,500 foot linear alignment. The soils are still logged every 5 feet in the vado zone, and they're logged continuously now, you know, below the first saturated zone. And you start seeing the complexity where there was a lot of gray. We're starting to see more light green and some more darker greens, meaning more permeable units. As we add more information, and now we have 60 borings across this 3,500 linear foot alignment, all the soils are logged continuously. And you can start seeing the evolution of this cross section is becoming significantly more complex. You see the blue lines representing different water table elevations seasonally or perched. We start seeing the clays are not, you know, they're linear across, but we have stringers of more permeable units. And now you can start seeing that if we're going to target an in situ remedy, this becomes a lot more complex in terms of the placement of the amendments that we need to add to the formation to be successful in the remediation. So design characterization, what do we need to know? And I think here it becomes down to these five fundamentals. We need to know a lot more about the geology so we can define that flow regime. The hydrogeology, what are those properties that influence flow and the transport of the contaminant through the geology itself? The geochemistry, what are the electron acceptors? What might be competitors that might affect the injected amendments that we're injecting? And are we going to end up with metal mobilizations, which is always a regulatory question? And across the microbiology, are there potentials for degradation pathways or potential for degradation of the contaminants that we're trying to resolve? So here's an interesting graphic that's in the document itself, basically showing what happens if you do RDC versus not doing RDC. So our clients always ask us, so the regulatory agencies ask, what is the benefit of doing more work up front versus just going ahead and injecting the material and waiting for the outcome? And if it doesn't work, we'll do some more later. So it's really, what is this value of the investigation, VOI? That's what this graphic's all about. Really, why spend more money on characterization when you can be spending more money on cleanup? I don't know how many times I've heard that. And if you always go back to the characterization, you'll get to the cleanup solution faster. And so when the in-situ remedies fail, it's often due to this lack of insufficient detail conceptual site model. So if we look at the graphic, there's a red and blue line. The red is the traditional line of going out, spending the money on cleanup and not spending it on characterization. So you have an ineffective remedy. You're reworking the site longer time frames. With the RDC, you have a much better understanding while spending a little bit more money up front. But you notice the line doesn't go as high on the chart in terms of costs. So the effective remedy results in less cost and a reduced time frame in terms of the overall remedial strategy. So at the end of the day, you end up resolving the problem sooner and cheaper. So here's another case study where we have a client here that has a site in California, in the Central Valley. It's got VOCs impacted to soils and groundwater. We're in a floodplain deposit for geology, and the target treatment zone are the sand lenses that are several feet thick and approximately 15 feet below grade. The client's in a rush due to a redevelopment timeframe, and the remedial goal was to enhance in-situ bioremediation by implementing sodium lactate. So you can sort of see the 1,000-foot section, 20 feet thick, and you can sort of see the zone of influence or the zone that we're targeting generally in the orange zone itself. So the remedy was implemented, and the good news and the bad news. The good news is the geology was pretty well characterized. The injections were properly performed within the sand intervals themselves. The bad news is the hydraulic conductivity was not evaluated. An injection test was not performed. Geochemical parameters were not used to assess the EISB variability, no treatability study or no treatability testing. The choice of substrate and dosing was based upon similar sites. I've done it before. It'll work here at this site as well. Microbial studies were not performed, and the upgradient source was not assessed or removed. So a lot of that goes back to how much do we understand before we went out and we conducted the in-situ remedy. So the outcome was no reductions in groundwater contaminant concentrations, and the site redevelopment was delayed. So what ended up happening? We have a poll question that just popped up. So I'll get back to what happened. Have you ever had to perform an in-situ rework because of poor initial site characterization. So if you could choose either yes or no, then we'll get back to the recharacterization on this site. And Devin, why don't we just give them a minute and then we can close this poll.
Sounds good, Richard.
All right, let's see what the results are. So I think we've got 75% of the audience had to reperform or rework because of poor initial site characterization. And 25% of you did a very good job, and I commend that 25% for not having to do additional work. So if we can close this poll. So what ended up having to do in this site is exactly that, as the 75% indicated. We need a better definition of the source area. We had to redefine or better delineation of the plume, more aquifer testing to further evaluate hydraulic conductivity and the radius of influence, microbial testing. Treatability studies were completed to assess various substrates and specific doses. As you remember, previously we identified it based upon other site information, and the upgradient source was removed. And that's always a very important one, because if you have a continuous source and you're trying to remedy something, the strength of that source or the mass is still coming in, and you have to account for that in your total dosing. So let's take a look at the cost outcome. So we have two side-by-side comparison in terms of this table in the document. We have the initial characterization, which is on the first line. Each of those was $150,000. The upfront RDC initially wasn't done, another $160,000 if we use the RDC. The implementing of the remedy and the monitoring, the rework, the remedy implications are the same. The monitoring and closing are the same. But let's take a look for a second in terms of the upfront RDC, which is consistent with the RDC that had to be done with the rework. So that was the same cost, whether it was done upfront or the second time around. And what ended up happening, if you look at the third column, where you have 8 years in the study to complete the remedy, you know, with the additional RDC, the remedy was completed in 5. So the total cost savings here was about $380,000, or about a third of the total cost. But more importantly, the study was completed 3 years quicker. And again, if we can complete any remedy sooner and get the closure, is a much better solution. So in the document itself, we have this table 2.2, which has a lot of information, and I don't expect anybody to be reading this document, but more or less looking at the headers that we have, and we'll get into that in a couple slides. But as we look at what do we have physical properties, flow properties, and aqueous geochemical properties in this table. We have microbiology and degradation potentials. So all of those are critical information in terms of understanding an in situ remedy. So if we look at the table a little closer, the headers themselves are giving you alternative screening techniques, whether they're high, medium, or low, remedial design and performance monitoring. We have in here in situ approaches, whether or not we're biotic or abiotic. And then the legend is whether or not they're more or less applicable. So you can see that in the first two columns next to the parameters, and then the color codes indicating the relevance importance of that data being low to high. So you can sort of use this as a guide in terms of collecting additional data. But as we drill down further into the physical properties themselves, we've added some additional benefits as you look at this. So you have the parameters in the table itself, but because this is an interactive web-based document, you can actually go to provenance and minerals. You can hover over that And when you hover over that, you'll get a definition on each of these physical properties. So you can see what the definition is. So you can look at the benefit of having to say the provenance and mineralogies, or look at stratigraphy, looking at the formation with layers, looking at gravels, silts, clays. You know, all of those are going to add to the information for your final remedy. In the flow properties, very similar. Again, you can sort of see the color code in terms of most of these are high importance. But again, if you look at, you know, heterogeneity, which I work in the Northeast, so heterogeneity is a very important thing for my projects, because if in fact we assume that we have, you know, sort of pancake geology in the Northeast, we're going to fail miserably on our remedies. So we really need to look at the different types of heterogeneities that are within the formation. Flow properties, again, we start seeing that we need to look at, you know, things like an isotropy. You know, how is the injection? Again, looking back at that radius of influence study that wasn't done on that previous case study. So if we knew what the radius of influence was and we had a better understanding as the flow regime and that amendment being forced into the aquifer, what was that going to look like? We have that information ahead of time to be able to look at what the spacing might be and those types of things that Elizabeth and Suzanne will discuss. And then you also look at, you know, sulfate. Is sulfate one of those areas that, you know, you might have to look at? And you can look at sulfate might be present in a formation, which might inhibit or might enhance your amendment that you're going to inject into the aquifer, because, you know, it might provide a long-term anaerobic chemical reduction. And so understanding those chemical properties prior to an injection program may be very beneficial. And again, we can sort of see the sulfate where we are on the reducing chart on the redox ladder. And if we can bring up the poll question, please, Devin. So in your experience, has sulfate been beneficial or an inhibitor to in situ implementation? So if you can choose either whether it was a benefit or inhibitor, we'll see what the poll and the majority have to say on this. So Devin, could you bring up the results of the poll, please? Well, that's an interesting result. It's a 50-50. So, you know, a lot of times, you know, you can find it to be a benefit when you're trying to reduce maybe something like hexavalent chromium, or it can be an inhibitor. And I think both are correct. It just depends on what you are trying to remediate and how effective you're going to be. But understanding that sulfate may be either a benefit or inhibitor as you're moving forward with your characterization, because that will affect the final outcome of your remedy. So again, looking at more aqueous geochemistry, we see chloride is also another parameter that can also be evaluated for in your geochemistry. And again, Devin, could you bring up this poll question, please? So in your experience, can chloride concentrations be effectively used as a line of evidence of reductive dechlorination? So we'll give you a few to respond yes or no to this question. And again, as we're waiting for lines of evidence, remember, we're looking at the remedy itself. We do know that, you know, chloride may be present in the environment from if you're in a snow-loving area versus, you know, those of us who are not in the South who don't have to deal with snow. But Evan, could you bring up the responses on this, please? So I think on this one here, there's more yeses at 61% versus 39%. And again, we could use chloride. So if you could close, I can close it. We can look at chloride to see whether or not we've seen reductive dechlorination as a means. But again, if you're closer to areas where you have landfills or seawater intrusion, or like I said, in the Northeast, where there's a lot of, salts that are put down with chlorides, you know, those can tend to be difficult to look at whether or not the remedy is working as well. But it definitely is a plus to look at and should be included in any assessment. Microbe and degradation potentials, again, you can start seeing fairly consistent here in terms of dissolved hydrocarbons gases. And again, you know, I've got sites where we're monitoring methane because we've done the methanogenesis in terms of reductive, in terms of compounds, and we want to make sure that methane isn't going to be a secondary problem as a result of the remedy. The remedy was very good at reducing the contaminant, but we don't want to have, you know, basically methane as an issue underneath a building. So we monitor for that. And again, that's something from a dissolved gases standpoint is known, you know, prior to, but also post-injection if that's going to be an issue. And Devin, that brings us, I think, to our first question and answer period. So perhaps you want to take a look and see if we have any questions.
All right. Thank you, Richard. So like you just said, this is our first question and answer portion of our training today. We do have another one at the end of the training around 3 o'clock. So we'll have these two opportunities to answer some questions verbally. I would like to just remind everybody that the CEUs are available. I did put the link in the chat earlier at the beginning of the webinar, and those will be the registration for those will be closing at 2 o'clock. So just keep that in mind. If you're interested, now would be the time to see that through. And then also just to remind you, we do have a feedback form and certificates of completion available at the end of today. So those will be available at the end of the training. So with that, I'm going to look to our Q&A pod to see if we have any questions for our trainers to address. If we don't at this time, then we can move on to our next next presenter. And then we do have a Q&A at the end of the training as well. So I'll pause here and see if we get any questions in our Q&A pod. And if not, then we will move on. So it doesn't look like we have any questions. So just to keep everybody attentive, we will move on to our next portion of the training here with Suzanne O'Hara. All right, so Suzanne with GeoSyntech, if you are ready, let's kick it off.
All right, great. Thanks. So I'm going to be talking about the design portion of the guidance document, so designing your remedy, specifically looking at amendment, dose, and delivery. And I have lost control. Oh, there we go. So the design really involves the consideration of the proposed amendment, the delivery method, and the dose, applied simultaneously throughout your in-situ design characterization, in your design itself, in the implementation, and the monitoring process as well. And any step in that sequence or in that design process can be repeated as new information becomes available. So in this section, we're going to touch on some of the key topics covered in this section, which is section 3 of the guidance document. So if you haven't got the message yet, all parts of remediation is iterative, and we're really going to be focusing in this section on the iterative nature of the design. So we've got that graphic that we talked about earlier, where we have the dose, delivery, and amendment as a design wheel. And the refinement of the design follows a selection of your amendment and your delivery strategy, and it can involve various tests. And all of those tests can apply that dose delivery and amendment design feedback. So, for instance, if you're doing your design and you want to do a bench test, you can, you know, have that dose delivery and amendment in your bench test. You implement it, you monitor it. You can optimize it either by going back up and redoing your bench test with some changes, or maybe you're ready at that stage to step into your pilot test phase, where again, you're going to be looking at your dose delivery amendment, implement that, monitor, and again, optimize. So you've got your optimization staircase there. And I think it's the main message here is that the results of each one of those tests feed back into the refinements of the subsequent test and your overall design. And also that the cyclical nature of your that design wheel is extended into the implementation phase of testing and monitoring, whether that's at a bench test, at a pilot test, or at full-scale implementation. So one of the first things you need to do with your design, of course, is determine what your target treatment zone is going to be. So your target treatment zone definition is often also an iterative process. You have to consider things like collateral effects, the performance monitoring, costs, and those collateral effects or costs and performance can feed into revising that target treatment zone as your design is developed. Some of the key considerations for defining your target treatment zone might be your cleanup objectives. The objectives could be reducing your source area mass, protection of a particular receptor, meeting an interim remedial goal, maybe achieving site closure, which I think is a goal for a lot of us, or other site-specific objective. If you have more than one remedy is planned for your site, then you need to understand the spatial and temporal relationship to other remedies when you're doing that. For example, if you have in-situ chemical oxidation is something that you're maybe considering for your source area, where you might be thinking of in-situ chemical reduction in your plume area, then you need to understand the target treatment zone for each of those remedies and how they can, you know, your downgradient transport of your source remedy, your ISCO remedy could affect your ISCO remedy. Another thing to consider are uncontrolled amendment discharges. So if you have a potential for unintended discharge of injection and amendments, for instance, discharge of groundwater to surface water, then you need to consider the potential for that transport of the amendments to the discharge area and maybe change your design and your treatment area. And then, of course, the geology, the hydrogeology, and the geochemical characteristics of your site are also going to be key components to consider when you're setting up your target treatment zone. So there are various design support elements that we talk about in the document. And those design support elements are an extension of your conceptual site model and your remedial design characterization data. And the number one source of failure for amendment and injection is lack of an adequately defined characterization of your target treatment zone and reliance on an oversimplified conceptual site model. So some of those design elements that we're going to go over at a high level today are modeling and analytical tools, laboratory bench testing, and field pilot tests. So in order to help us work through some of the examples or discussion of section three of the document, we have this idealized, I guess, a contaminated site case study. So this is an industrial site where there's been a solvent release. We've already gone and done the design characterization for this site. So we know where the mass is. You know, we know we've got contaminant mass in the sands and silts at the site, and they extend into the underlying clays. We know groundwater flows from left to right. You know, we've got a pretty good understanding of this site. And so we're ready to design our remedy. And we're going to use some of those design support elements to work through our design. So we've characterized this site, and now we would like to consider doing either in-situ chemical oxidation or bioremediation. So this is the case study we'll use as we work through this. So one of the tools that you can use to help with your supporting your design are modeling and analytical tools. Those can be parameter estimation tools, groundwater flow and transport models or geochemical reaction models. And they can be simple spreadsheet calculations to very complex 3D models. And some of the software used for these different modeling and analytical tools is in the public domain, and others are commercially available and require a license. And table 3.1 in the document provides a list of the models that are in the public domain and a description of those models and how they might be used. So bench testing is another really useful tool that can be used to help with your design. It can help to determine the type and dosing of amendments. It provides data to support remedial technologies or series of specific treatments. And ideally, it's using site-specific materials, groundwater or soils from your site, to confirm that the treatment is effective for your site-specific chemistry. It can be used at all sites, but is definitely recommended in situations where the chemistry is really complex or where you might be using multiple treatment steps. And generally, bench testings are scale testing and treatability testing are effective and timely in evaluating the degradation or transportation of contaminants or suites of contaminants. They're often conducted under ideal mixing conditions, which can increase or decrease the resulting amendment requirement estimates relative to field conditions. So if you know, if you take a look at that, the photo at the bottom there, those are, you know, on little treatment bottles sitting with perfect connection between your groundwater and your soils on a shaker table at, you know, in 25 degrees Celsius in the lab. It's going to give you some information, but it's not really giving you the complexity that you're going to have in the field. So field heterogeneities and its influence on amendment transport, reaction kinetics, and other characteristics can't be accurately duplicated in the lab. You get a little bit closer if you use column tests, which are shown here on the top, where you're actually getting at least some amount of transport distance along your amendments or you know, depending on how you've set up these column tests, you're getting sort of a 1D flow. So they are generally not accurate models of the field conditions due to issues of scale, but they are initial screening levels of evaluations of potential outcomes and effects of treatment, and they can be utilized to inform and initially optimize your field remedial design and monitoring strategies. One thing that bench tests are good for are considering secondary effects, and that is something that you need to be doing when you're designing your remedy. Some of those secondary effects can occur over a wide range of time, transient shifts lasting hours or days, so maybe increases in water elevation because you've done an injection, or temporary shifts in pH, or longer term changes that can last years, such as switches and redox due to amendments. So some of those might be desired secondary effects, but some of them may not be. And so you need to evaluate and potentially mitigate those secondary effects. For instance, the addition of sodium persulfate can affect the natural or anthropogenic chromium present in soil or aquifer matrix, which can be oxidized to hexavalent chrome. So that is maybe one of those secondary effects that you want to be aware of and mitigate if you can, or consider a different remedy if you can't and the risks are not manageable. So some of those considerations, understanding what those secondary effects are and how you might mitigate them, can begin with a bench test and pilot tests. So I'm going to get you to open a poll. The poll is, have you ever used a bench test in your design for an in situ remedy? All right, maybe close that poll and see what results we have there. It looks like more than half of us have used bench tests. And then I guess as a secondary poll question to that one is, if you have used bench testing for an in situ remedy, did the results change your approach? All right, maybe we'll see what part two looks like. So for some people, again, similar sort of breakdown in numbers of those who have done it, it does look like some of them, it changed the approach. So it's providing data that, again, can help you optimize the next steps. So if we go back to our case study, we've taken some soils from the site and groundwater from the site, and we're running some bench testing. We were going to consider in situ chemical oxidation and bioremediation for this site. The bench test results show that the in situ chemical oxidation is faster than the bio, but we are seeing more secondary effects, and there's probably a higher oxidant demand than we would be ideal. Compared to the bio, where although it is slower than the ISCO, we are having fewer secondary effects. When we run the math of the donor usage, and the donor tested in this case study was emulsified vegetable oil, it turns out to be cheaper long term and easier to handle. And this is the remedy that was chosen to move forward in the design. So we're finished our bench testing. Now we have to consider the next thing, which could be field pilot tests. So pilot tests are they allow you to evaluate the impacts of heterogeneities on the performance of your remedial technology. You can evaluate remedy timeframes under real-world conditions, combining effects of dilution, advective flow, diffusion, adverse chemical interactions at your site. Determine the amendment distribution, rate of injection, radius of influence, what you might see it, you know, what you might get from different pressures of volumes during your injection. It also allows you to evaluate those secondary effects. Are you mobilizing metals? Are you creating acid production? And one thing also that pilot test can help you with is actually designing your performance monitoring network for your full-scale remedy. So how quickly are things moving? Where are you, you know, where should you be setting up that monitoring network? So these are small-scale preliminary field events performed at the site under site-specific in-situ conditions, and they're used to test the assumptions incorporated into the design of the full-scale remedy. And pilot tests can be something as simple as going out, installing a well, and doing a potable water injection to see what kind of injection rates you get at different pressures and volumes. And some pilot tests are very large and maybe even, you know, depending on the complexity of the site and the size of the site, your pilot test might be larger than the full scale remedy of another site. So, but they are very useful tools for collecting all sorts of information. So one of the things that needs to be considered in your design is the geologic heterogeneity and the effects that has on your delivery. The geologic heterogeneity results in preferential flow generally through those higher permeability zones. In this depiction, the earth tone colors represent the various geologic layers, with darker browns as the lower permeability zones. So this is a tight formation versus maybe this, which is a sands. The warmer colors represent the area of contamination with the highest concentrations identified as orange. And then our purple color is our amendment that we're injecting into the subsurface. So in the case on the left, the less heterogeneity, case with the less heterogeneity, you're getting a delivery of your amendment in the vicinity of each of the delivery points is more uniform than when you compare it to the results of the case on the right, where you're getting a lot more variability in the lateral influence versus depth. So these are just some of the things you need to keep in mind when you're designing a remedy. The distribution is not only an effect of that permeability, with the higher permeability zones taking generally more of those fluids and allowing the broadest radial delivery, but it's also partially controlled by the nature of the amendment itself. So if you have a soluble donor or amendment that you're adding in, say like ethanol, compared to a semi-soluble, like maybe emulsified vegetable oil, or insoluble or particulate injection like zero-valent iron, those amendments are also going to control the distribution. And one of the things we note here is that back diffusion of contaminated mass storage in low permeability materials can be a significant source of contribution to long-term plume or development. So you just need to keep that in mind when you're characterizing your site. So another thing that affects the delivery strategy is the pressure. So if you're doing a high pressure emplacement technology using something like hydraulic or pneumatic injection methods, those are going to deform the aquifer matrix and propagate seams or fractures within the matrix. And you need to use those when you're using particles with, let's say, solid particles like oxygen-releasing material, zero-valent iron, or activated carbon, when the particles themselves are larger than the pore throat. So you can't actually inject those and expect them to move because they're bigger than the available space to move. So you have to deform the aquifer matrix using those high pressure techniques. Soluble amendments like organic carbon substrates or chemical oxidants can be delivered under those high pressure fracturing methods, but they can also be low flow or low pressure injection, as well as even just gravity flow. So there's a table 3.4 in the document that identifies various delivery techniques, and each one of those delivery techniques has a fact sheet in Appendix D, and there's a link in the table to each one of those fact sheets. So that's what's across the top. The left-hand column looks at the hydrogeologic characteristics, and so you pick the hydrogeologic characteristic that matches your site, and as you work through the table, it will identify which of those delivery techniques are either widely used, maybe site-specific at use at, for that type of characteristic, or maybe that technique is not applicable at that site. And each fact sheet in Appendix D includes information on the delivery techniques, like the type of equipment that you would use, the advantages and limitations of the techniques, and health and safety considerations. So we're going to go back to our case study here and do a pilot test. So again, we're doing emulsified vegetable oil, which was what our bench test told us was our good option for this site. And we're going to be instrumenting this site, doing some injections, and monitoring the performance. And monitoring data collected during this implementation phase is key data. So you're getting potential to get new additional lithology data when you install those wells, chemistry data as you sample those wells, and all of, and then when you're doing your injection, you're also getting different kinds of behavior data from like the pressure at the different depths. And all of this data can feed into refining and optimizing both your conceptual site model as well as your full-scale design. So in this situation, what we see in the sand and silts is that we're getting a really good radius of influence. We're able to inject at low injection pressures, and we're getting really good distribution. And the clay layer, on the other hand, we're injecting at really high pressures, and getting very poor distribution, an uneven and small radius of influence. And there's evidence that it's actually short-circuiting up into that sand and gravel layer, or sort of sand and silt layer. So this is telling us, our pilot test is telling us that this is a good remedy for the sands and silts, but we need to maybe reevaluate what we're doing in that clay layer. So I'm going to open up another poll question here and ask if people have used pilot tests in their design for in situ remedies. All right, maybe we'll close that one and see the results of that. Looks like a lot of people have used pilot tests, which is great. And then the second part of that, for those that have used pilot tests, did the results change your design? All right, let's see the results of that one. Yeah, so a lot of people have taken the information from those pilot tests as needed, change the design of their remedy. So we've gone full scale now. We're ready. We've designed our remedy based on all of those tests that we've done. We've designed the remedy and implemented it for that sand layer. So we've got all sorts of injection. We've added our EVO, and we're in the long-term monitoring phase for the sand layer. But what are we going to do with that clay layer? So in our optimization staircase, we're actually going to go back up potentially to the bench test level, because we don't know what our remedy will be here. So what we've decided to test here is a switch to electrokinetic bioremediation. Electrokinetic remediation approaches use low-level direct current power to distribute amendments in low permeability matrices. You can use them for, in the case of electrokinetic bio, you can use those to distribute your electron donor, such as lactate or acceptors, oxygen or nitrate. And you can actually also use it to distribute the microorganisms themselves since they're charged and to promote biodegradation. So we're going to go back to the bench test at this stage because we don't know that it's going to work for this site. We've taken clay from that clay layer and groundwater from that clay layer, and we're setting up a bench test where we've got an anode and a cathode cell on either side of our clay. And we're applying that direct current to see if we can migrate the lactate through our media. And we've switched from emulsified zero-valent iron to lactate because that works better as a donor for EK. So what we're seeing in our bench test is that we are able to transport that lactate through the clay. So we get to move on to our pilot test and again, do a pilot test here to make sure it's going to work at our site scale. We've set up a very simple test with two wells, a cathode well and an anode well, and we add our amendments and turn on the current, and we're getting lactate migration through our contaminated zone. And it's a successful test. So we're able to move on to implementing the full-scale EK Bio at that site. So they're not shown on here, but we've got our ongoing remediation in the sand and silt layer, and we've instrumented the site now to do the EK with a series of cathode and anode wells and turning on the current, which is what's shown in blue here, and we can distribute our amendments throughout our treatment zone. And, you know, you can switch which wells are anodes and cathodes to maximize your distribution across your treatment interval. And there is a fact sheet on EK in the guidance document Appendix B, which talks a little bit more detail about how it's implemented and how it can be used. So to date, we've been looking at images showing the delivery in cross-section, but one component of amendment delivery optimization is how to lay out your network of injection points. So there's different ways of doing it. The grid pattern is basically the most broadly applicable. There are very few site-specific constraints that would challenge the method. One thing to consider, though, is you might want to start by injecting on the outside and then moving inward in your target treatment zone to minimize spreading your plume before you have any amendment there to do some treatment. The second one is the injection and drift, and that's going to be applicable in situations where your amendment is soluble in water and your groundwater velocities are either relatively high or your amendment is relatively persistent in the subsurface, so it doesn't get consumed between your two rows of injection points. You can do a recirculation method where you're simultaneously injecting and extracting groundwater. That strategy can be used to increase the lateral extent of amendment influence, and it also can help to reduce the risk of daylighting of amendment. So at the beginning there, when we talked about possibly having a risk of your amendment discharging to surface water, you could potentially set up a set of extraction wells along your surface water body to minimize that risk and control where your amendment's going. And then the last one there is a barrier, and it's a barrier to contaminant migration, not to your groundwater flow. So it just sets up a series of amendment delivery points that you get treated as groundwater flows through. And then, there's different behaviors as well of your amendments, and some of them are going to be high persistent. So if you're looking at electron donors, that might be emulsified zero-valent iron, which will last longer in the subsurface versus, say, ethanol, which will get consumed very quickly, which is low persistence. And then, of course, your site characteristics at low groundwater velocities, you're not going to get a lot of distribution. And at higher groundwater velocities, you will get a greater distribution or distance from over time from your initial injection. So the processes affecting amendment distribution are the advection as the result of the pressurized delivery itself, the advection due to natural groundwater flow, and then diffusion as a result of the concentration gradients. So remedial design is iterative. You need to constantly evaluate the data you have. You need to refine the design following selection of amendments and delivery strategies. And that can be done through bench testing or pilot testing. And the main thing is that the results of each of those tests need to feed back refinements into the subsequent test or the next version of the design. An iterative approach and constant evaluation of new data will provide a strong design and more successful remedial efforts. And with that, I'm going to pass it on to Elizabeth, who's going to talk about implementation, monitoring, and interpretation.
Super. Thanks so much, Suzanne. So I'm going to talk about section four of the text. Oops. And that's about implementation and the actual monitoring of, you know, how do you monitor your data? How do you know how to interpret the data so that you can optimize and implement any other changes that need to be done to make your project successful? Oops, sorry. Okay. For some reason, this does not look like it did when we were in our... There we go. Okay. As we've discussed already, we do a lot of different types of monitoring. You have done your site characterization, which was probably, more related to where is the plume, where's the source area, and let me delineate the plume. And then you've done your remediation design characterization, where you've looked at some other parameters that say, is this going to be suitable for bioremediation or is it going to be suitable for in situ chemical oxidation or one of those other types of remedial technologies. You also have process monitoring. Different technologies that you implement will have different rates of reaction, different amendments or different parameters for which you need to analyze. For instance, if you have an ISCO remedy, that's a relatively quick process. You may even be able to use some parameters like temperature and some things that are very, very immediate. On a bioremediation project, you may be looking for parameters such as microbial counts, and those processes are much slower, and it may take a while to get the right conditions for a bioremediation scenario to really start taking place. Field parameters, I can't express this enough. They are inexpensive and they have tremendous amount of value. I know a lot of folks get out in the field and they think, I'm just doing that to make sure everything's stabilized before I collect my sample. And it doesn't matter what the pH is, as long as the pH is within, 0.1 of the last one or 10% or whatever your criteria is for your particular state or program. But what that really tells us is, is the pH appropriate for a microbiological process, or would you be better off doing, some other like an ISCO, or, if the pH is already low, that's great for certain ISCOs, not so great for bio. There's a schematic here of the well network. And you'll see, we've set up the wells. You've got your injection wells. You don't normally sample the injection wells. You will sample your source monitoring wells. You also want to sample your plume extent wells or your distal end plumes. You may have fringe wells. You may have point of compliance wells. So there are all sorts of sites, depending on your program, as to what you're going to have with respect to where you sample, what you sample for. Certain programs, your regulator is going to be interested in different things than you might be interested in. I'm not saying your regulator is not interested, but I'm just saying that your regulator definitely needs to know if you're creating vinyl chloride, if you've got some other secondary water quality issues that are arising, and that's important to everyone. But there are also some other things that you might be interested in knowing, like how much is my residual total organic carbon? From a compliance perspective, that's not so important, but from a bioremediation project, total organic carbon is very important because that's your food source for your bugs. So you'll notice in section four that you know, we talk about the different types of remedies and generalities. So we've got the anaerobic biostimulation category. We've got the chemical oxidation category. We've got chemical reduction. There's a table like this for suggested analytical parameters for each one of those classifications of remedies. And so I don't expect you to read this here, but, you know, just pointing out a couple of things, like you'll see ultimate end products are on both tables for bio and for chemical oxidation. For every remedy, that's going to be important. It may tell you something a little bit different. There may be daughter products for bio remediation, particularly for chlorinated solvents when it's reductive dechlorination. You don't see those daughter products. You know, you're not checking for those if you do an ISCO remedy, because it's a totally different process. A couple of things that are important to note, recommendations they make on this table are things like this one. If sulfate reduction and methane are not observed and ORP is greater than negative 120, conditions really don't exist for sulfate reduction. Similarly, notes in here that methanogenesis occurs between negative 200 and negative 400 millivolts. I see this all the time when I review documents. They say, oh, it's, you know, negative 50 and therefore reductive dechlorination is occurring. That is not a low enough ORP for reductive dechlorination. You know, I might say it could exist at negative 150. I'm not going to hold it to that negative 200, but I don't believe reductive dechlorination is happening at a negative 50. I just don't think that's not appropriate. So this table has a lot of really valuable information on how to interpret your data. You've got your pH, you know, your bugs are going to like it when it's, you know, ideally 6.8 to 7.5. And there you can flex in that range quite a bit. Bugs are pretty adaptable. But if your pH is 4.5, I suggest you don't do a bio remedy. A couple of other things to think about, end products may dissipate very quickly in the beta zone. And therefore, a lot of these end products like carbon dioxide, chloride, I see them analyzed more and more frequently. And then you're scratching your head, how do I use this data? Because I don't actually see it. Well, that doesn't mean it was never there. It could have just dissipated very quickly. So you need to look at the whole body of data that you're collecting and not rely on the one thing and say, oh, it's not working because I didn't see chloride. You may not see it. It's all very transient. Some things happen quickly. Some things happen slowly. So look at all of the data you have. Sorry, I didn't think this was actually animating correctly, but I see it is. Okay. So section 4 talks a lot about applying the optimization to underperforming remedies. And a couple of things you need to ask yourself, you know, do you actually know why your remedy is not performing as designed? So we need to noodle that out and make sure that we understand what's going on so that we can optimize the right element of the project. You know, is it, you know, dose, delivery, or the amendment? You know, we'll keep going back to those three key elements every time. Have you collected all the data you need to evaluate progress? So on the first slide, I should have talked a little more about baseline sampling. So let's say you've got baseline sampling and you didn't collect your dissolved iron and manganese and some of these other things, sulfate, sulfide. If you didn't collect your baseline, then, you know, a lot of those parameters, you're looking at the change. How does sulfate change? How does sulfide change as the project progresses? So if you didn't collect it at the beginning, you're not going to know what the change is. You can look at it and say, okay, I collected sulfate data and I have no sulfate. So does that mean that I never had any to begin with, or has it all, you know, converted to sulfide at this point? You can't answer that question completely, but if you do, you know, think back, well, maybe that is important, I should take it, and you do have sulfate present, then you can start comparing it at least to something. But you've got to always be careful that there's false negatives if you did not collect the correct baseline data. Another thing I would say, there's no point in collecting data that you no longer need. So that you, if you've already gotten to the point where, you know, all your sulfate's gone and you don't keep collecting it unless you're adding it. Now, if you continue to amend with it, that's a different story. But, you know, if the natural system doesn't have it, you know, don't feel free to change your sampling plan and use those resources somewhere else. And let's not collect data that, begs interpretation when there's really nothing to say about it. More importantly, you know, as we move along and look at our data and which design criteria need to be addressed, you know, can it actually be optimized? You always have to, you know, think in the back of your mind, well, there may be a point to which the best thing to do might be to cut bait and change up your remedy. And at that point, you need to think about, well, what remedy is compatible with what I just did? So if you just injected a whole bunch of carbon into the system for a bioremediation project, you probably don't want to follow it up with, permanganate or ISCO or something like that that's going to be scavenging all of that carbon that you just added, your organic carbon, and not your chemicals of concern that you're trying to get rid of. And should a supplemental remedy be considered? And I'm going to talk you through a case study. It's an actual project I worked on several years ago, where we did supplement the remedy. We kept adding a couple of other tricks to the trade to address some of the issues that we were observing as we worked through our optimization. So here's our case study. And we're going to spend a pretty good amount of time on this. So it's a bioremediation project, reductive dechlorination. So the total site is 380 acres. It's in a Superfund CERCLA program. The plume itself is 12 acres. It's about 8 acres on site, 4 acres off site. So we did have some off site concerns. It was in the saprolite and the transition zone of a Piedmont geology, varying thicknesses. I'm going to show you a cross section of that here in a minute. Contaminants of concern were primarily carbon tetrachloride mixed with TCE and, of course, the daughter products of both of those. The carbon tet was about 4 parts per million, and the TCE was about 1 part per million. They had a pump and treat that was operating for approximately 13 years. It provided a little bit of hydraulic control to keep the plume from, you know, moving too far off site. But beyond that, concentrations really were not going in the right direction. They weren't significantly declining after 13 years. So we looked at, could we optimize the pump and treat system? But this being in the Piedmont geology, you know, the yield of those wells was, you know, less than 1 gallon a minute. And the formation just really wasn't going to give up the water, and its pump and treat really wasn't the best remedy for this site. So we looked at doing anaerobic bioremediation, and the substrate we injected into this would happen to be dilute molasses. So a couple of pointers that I want to talk about before I really dig in is that what made this project really successful is that we didn't wait until the annual report came around to really evaluate the data. We went out there monthly, collected field parameters, quarterly on VOCs, TOC, total organic carbon, and some of the other primary analytes. But we relied a lot on the field parameters. Is our pH in the right place? Do we have the right amount of, is the ORP where we want it to be? DO, those types of parameters, because they are so important. We also calculated when to anticipate a change in our monitoring well. So we knew what the travel time was between our injection well and our monitoring well. And we expected to see total organic carbon arrive at that well within, you know, 30 days, 60 days, 90 days, whatever it is. And we kept an eye on that as well. We ended up incorporating hydraulic fracturing to improve distribution. So these were drilled wells, two-inch stainless steel wells that we installed. We relied on the natural downward vertical gradient to distribute amendments into the bedrock. We had a contingency plan to install bedrock wells to address the bedrock here. But it turns out once we cleaned up the aquifer above it and cut it off, it all very quickly attenuated. And I would say it's probably more attenuation that resolved the bedrock issues than it was the amendments really getting into the bedrock themselves. So here we go. Here's a cross-section of how the wells were installed. So we actually did a lot of characterization of the site during the installation of 134 injection wells. So our target treatment zone was a little over 4 acres, 134 wells. We sampled and looked at the lithology of each and every well as we went down. And I always stop here and say how important it is to look at the lithology of each well, even though they are so close together, because the information is really valuable. There is what I call a sister site for this project that is located only like 15 miles away. Same Piedmont geology, same chemicals of concern, except for it was flip-flopped. It was more TCE, less carbon tet. And we did it the year after we implemented this one. And we took a shortcut and we did not log every hole. And when we went back and we had some problems, we had to go, like Richard said, had to go back and do some more characterization to see what the problem is. And we found that we had a clay layer there that had all this sword material to it. And we weren't cleaning it up because we weren't addressing that particular zone where all of the mass was hung up. So take the time, collect the boring information, know what your lithology is. But anyway, one of the interesting things about this particular site was that the contamination, the highest concentrations of VOCs happened to be in the trough of this bedrock trough. And the transition zone was thinnest at the bottom of the trough and a little bit thicker up here at the edges. And then the contamination kind of bled off right up here in the corners, very low, much lower concentrations here on the edges. Even though we weren't really at concentrations for DNAPL, we saw that, it mostly followed the trough. And what you're going to see here in a minute is when we laid this out, so that we would never forget where the trough is, we put the main lateral for feeding the injection system right through, right on top of this trough. So we did the injections in separate only. It was in a grid system with overlapping wells. Here it is in plan view. It's automated injection. So we didn't, we did almost continuously, basically set the system up to inject 100 gallons per vertical foot of well. So if this is, 10 feet, it would get 1,000 gallons of injectate. And then once it started at the top of the system, here's the automated injection system. It would inject into each one of these wells, and they were fed typically about 3 wells per cycle. Each one of these wells could be individually controlled. And here's the lateral that defines, that's just laid on top of the bedrock trough right there. So here it is with the source area up here. Total VOC is approximately 5 parts per million, and the distal end of the plume groundwater flows in this direction. So after about 6 months, this is what we saw. Carbon tetrachloride went down. After about 4 months, it was looking really, really good, and cleaned it up in 6 months, looked awesome. At the same time, we saw the core form, which is the daughter product of carbon tet. It went up and it went down. Then methylene chloride is the next next one on that path, and it went up and it went down. And the methane came up and it eventually went down, but not within the 6 month time frame. So notice this says in the source area. So that was the good news. The bad news is, or what wasn't quite what was expected, is that, you know, if this is 5 parts per million and it cleaned up really quickly, and this area right here didn't clean up, what the heck's going on? So I think I may have a, not quite yet. So we did have an increase in daughter products. We had a very slight drop in pH after 12 months of operation. Methane concentrations increased, which is to be expected. If you don't know by now, if you're doing bioremediation and you are under a building, you need to be very concerned about methane buildup. But if this was an open area, we weren't particularly concerned and it did not get to, you know, dangerous conditions. One thing we noticed was that ideal redox conditions were not generated uniformly across the plume. The distal end of the plume exhibited very little change. I say no, but it was just little. It should have been easier to address those lower concentrations on the distal end of the plume than the 5 parts per million at the beginning. So here are redox conditions, and in general, I'll just define it. Methanogenic is basically where your ORP is negative 200 or lower. DO is less than 0.5. And over here, where it's aerobic, this is a positive ORP and a DO greater than 1. And so what we were seeing is that the redox conditions were ideal up here at the beginning of the plume. And still had not developed down here at the bottom end of the plume. So given what we just presented, what kind of problem do you think we have? What do we need to do to optimize this particular remedy? Okay. Are we getting an answer? Okay. All of the above. Yeah. And I think that there are little tweaks we can make on each one of those on dose delivery and the amendment. So here's what are we going to do? Okay. Suddenly it doesn't want to advance. Okay. Now it's going to advance lots. So one thing I would say, this lateral right here, the entire length of this is 350 feet and it's a 2-inch pipe. So there's approximately, you know, 60 gallons that stay in the pipe. So, you know, our premise was that up here closer to the source area, what was happening was we had a little more pressure behind the injections, which is allowing us to get a little bit bigger ROI. Whereas these down here at the distal end were simply gravity feed into the wells. And we really weren't quite getting the same ROI because so much of the amendment was getting tied up in the pipes, not just this one, but all of the pipes. And so it's like, okay, so are there some ways that we can optimize this, some little tricks that we can do to make sure that's you know, cleared out? So what we ended up doing, we revisited the RDC and our design wheel and did a few things to increase the ROI. So one of the things we did was we increased the volume from 10 gallons per vertical foot to 25 gallons per vertical foot. So that's going to get a whole lot more amendment out there. At the same time, what we did was lower the carbon load from 10% to 5%. So we didn't, what happens is if you have too much excess carbon or molasses or whatever your amendment is floating around there, it'll lead to a greater pH drop just because that fermentation process, you know, kicks out some acids and so it will drop your pH. So we lowered the carbon to 5% and then increased the volume. We also decreased the frequency of injection when we did this at the same time. And we added a clean water flush. And since it was very hot in the Carolinas, we added a stir to the holding tank because it was actually fermenting in our holding tank and bubbling over and making a huge mess. So we fixed that problem at the same time. So after 12 months of operation, we're looking pretty good. Again, out here in the periphery, but we've got this kidney-shaped spot right here that was being a little bit more stubborn, and we still had, carbon tap here, maybe one part per million or less, half a part per billion, 500 micrograms per liter or something like that. That was just being annoying. So we'll start this poll. What problem do you think we have now that we've, made those tweaks? Can we hone in on really, what the real problem is? We know that the amendment is working because we've seen, 80% of the site is cleaned up and looks great. So we know the amendment works. The dose, maybe we could change the dose, delivery. And here's where we looked at a couple of things about delivery. Do we need additional wells? We went back and looked at the boring logs. We noticed a clay layer, some silts, stuff like that. We're like, well, is there another technology out there, another way that we can really address this silty area and this area with a little more clay than the other boring logs had? What can we do? And Suzanne talked about a technology that works great for clays. So you want to finish up the poll here and we'll see what everybody has to say. Yeah, delivery. So I was leading you along that, the lines of that with my discussion, but yes, it's we decided it was a delivery issue that we needed to try something else to address that clay and silt layer. Okay, advance. Okay. So our initial optimization helped in most areas, but why did the COCs persist? And as I was mentioning, we reviewed those boring logs. The silt and clay lenses were evident in those boring logs when they were not evident in the other boring logs. So what's really occurring is back diffusion from clay acting as a long-term source. So what's happening is, and you'll see, this is how it's being injected, and it goes, these light brown and dark brown areas are the different silt and clay layers, and you'll see that it's prohibiting the injection. And you'll see that the injectate wants to go to the sandier, the lightest of the layers, and it's not getting into these deeper layers, but that's where the mass has gotten stuck, is in those clays. So we'll hydraulic fracturing help. So we worked with FRX on this and quite a few Clemson University students. This particular client's been wonderful about working with students to help them with some research opportunities to get towards their master's degrees. And so this was one of those sites. So it's really a lot of fun to work with the young folks on this and work with the people at Clemson and FRX. So the reagent takes the path of least resistance, which in this case, of course, is going to be the sands. And so we wanted to do a hydraulic study, pilot study, to see what the potential was for enhancing distribution by creating these extra sand layers. So we went back to here's our wheel again, and this is what we tell you, don't be afraid to do. Don't be afraid to go back after you're down here in the full scale phase. It's okay to go back up and do a bench scale or do a pilot test and start back over and do this reiteration optimization. And so that's exactly what we did. So how do you do hydraulic fracturing? This was done with DPT. So we took the tool in there and then you create a kerf and you basically pressure wash in this sand and guar gel. So we're using hydraulic fracturing as a proppant in this case. Sometimes we use hydraulic fracturing and we just simply put the amendments in that way. But in this case, what we were doing was creating these thin lenses. So in our pilot test, we created one lens about 40 feet below the ground surface. And then we installed a series of piezometers at various different heights. And then we injected into it. And it's not advancing. There we go. Okay, so we injected the fluid in. And then we had transducers in each one of these wells. And we watched the water table go up in, you know, the key wells. And what we were able to observe from that was that the influence was approximately 3 feet above and below the actual fracture that we placed there. Okay, now it's speed advancing. Okay. So then we implemented this on full scale once we did that. And so at the deepest, thickest part of the transitions, or where the saprolite was the thickest, we were able to get in seven fractures. Five fractures at 7 foot intervals. So we installed the five fractures, and then we installed an injection well in the center of those. And then we installed more piezometers. And you'll see on this sand rose over here what we did. We had these 20 feet out and 40 feet out. This grouping, the A grouping would be 20 feet out and the B grouping is 40 feet out. And they're set up in a rows like this. So we could monitor what is our radius of influence. Turns out we did see changes in each and every one of these wells at 40 feet out. So it was a very successful pilot test with the five fractures. And so we know now that we can get our injectate into that clay and silt layer through hydraulic fracturing and really expand our radius of influence. So full scale, we installed 11 of these fractures, and these down the middle, like I said, had five fractures each. So these others had either three or four, depending on the thickness and whether or not, you know, you had enough geology there to allow it. So it took 9 months to complete that pilot study and install that fracture set. So, you know, during that time, we weren't injecting anything. We were actually doing a rebound study and making sure that there was nothing, that the new equilibrium did not include any other residual COCs that would give us these lingering, you know, those annoying 10 microgram per liter concentrations that just never seem to meet MCLs. And what we found in this particular case was that, the back diffusion was really limited to areas with high clay content. And for the most part, there was no rebound at this site, meaning, you know, it really was, you know, the reductive decoordination was complete. We did not, this being primarily carbon tetrachloride, you don't have that annoying problem you have with TCE, with the with where cis DCE and vinyl chloride, you know, accumulate and just don't go. But we did have TCE at the site, and we saw none of those problems. So just to recap the whole project and the hydraulic fracturing, the ROI of each fracture was about 45 feet. There were 11 sets, so those were put on 75-foot center. We hooked those up to the automated injection system. We just unhooked some of the legs that weren't in use and hooked these up. We injected once a month, and after two injection events, the total organic carbon was at optimal levels at the monitoring wells. So for the first time, we're seeing optimal levels of TOC at those wells. Evidence of reductive dechlorination occurred at 6 months. And after 9 months, we transitioned to M&A for the rest of the site. And a recap of the redox parameters. So the redox is methanogenic down here, finally, where we did the hydraulic fracturing, and it's starting to recover up here in the source zone because we haven't not injected in the last 12 months up here. So you're starting to see the clean waterfront coming through. And the importance of this is to make sure, like I said, what is the new equilibrium? And if you've got a little bit of mass hung up in your silts and clays, that new equilibrium, it's going to turn out to be 5 or 10 micrograms per liter if you didn't get it all the first time. So it's real important to watch that and monitor when you're done and make sure that you have a permanent solution. So transitioning to M&A, a couple of important things, know when to stop. You know, a lot of times everybody's in a real big hurry to reach M&A, when if you did a cost benefit, you would see a lot of times that just simply running one more, your active remedy just a little bit longer might actually save you time and money in the long run. So consider that as you're looking at transitioning to M&A. Because 30 years of M&A is not cheap, and it's very, it's not very fun from my perspective either. So let's do a little bit more active remediation instead of just monitoring forever. Because you do get to a point of diminishing returns. Your regulatory framework, of course, is going to dictate when you can move to M&A. And that depends on what state you're in and what the cleanup goals are, and lots of different things factor into that, including the final use of the site. This particular site was a brownfield site, and the original agreement restricted the use to industrial. They had very few buyers interested in this property at the time, and it seems like everybody that came along wanted to build apartment complexes or retail. And so this turned out to be redeveloped as an apartment complex, and we were able to work with the developer and create the swimming pool in an area that was most appropriate for that. The client required vapor barriers. We assisted the developer with the design on those vapor barriers. This particular client had quite a lot of experience with emerging contaminants, where they thought they were complete at a site and then went out and sampled for one of these emerging contaminants and ended up, being back at it again. So they were very concerned about it becoming residential and required vapor barriers of the developer when they sold the property. So not a regulatory requirement, but just a really, just a conservative client. Recapping a 4.1-acre target treatment zone achieved MCLs or pretty close to MCLs throughout the entire 12-acre plume because natural attenuation occurred in the remaining 8 acres and in the bedrock as well. So this particular site transitioned to M&A when it was about 5 times the MCL. So the carbon TED was at 25 micrograms per liter, and so was the TCE when we transitioned that last little bit. Key concepts, things to keep remembering. This particular case study, including the original pump and treat, there were 4 cycles of optimization to reach M&A. I think that's pretty normal these days for large plumes, and even this is kind of, I guess, a medium-sized plume. But monthly evaluation of that data was critical to maintaining the schedule for redevelopment. That was a pretty hot schedule. That time is money in the real estate business, and it was really critical that we stay on schedule with that. And we did it through monthly evaluation of those field parameters and TOC and a lot of those inexpensive parameters. We had a lot of contingency plans drawn up for this site because it was so important to maintain that schedule. Luckily, we did not have to implement one for bedrock, but we did have to implement the one for hydraulic fracturing, and we were glad to have that plan already, you know, in the thought process, so we could do it quickly. So relating back to section four, we spent a lot of time talking about anaerobic biostimulation with the case study, but just know that the document goes into equal detail on aerobic biostimulation, ISCO, ISCR, even surfactant flushing and co-flushing. So take a close look at the document. You'll find that it's got a lot of neat tips and tricks. The appendices are solid. Just lots of really good recommendations, lots of advice on what data do you need to be collecting for each of these general strategies, and how to interpret it and how to use that and really, you know, make the right optimization decisions. There are links, everything's linked because it is an online document, links it to fact sheets, guidelines, optimization recommendations, even, best practices type things, some tips and tricks, and recommendations for sample frequency. And just know that, you know, a lot of the monitoring for ISCO is very, very different from in situ bioremediation. And with that, I'm going to hand it back over.
All right. I believe we have Chris wrapping it up for us here at the end. Chris, are you ready? You're not on mute, but I do not hear you. Oh, you're on mute now. We still cannot hear you.
I'm just wondering if taking away control of the slides for a second allows the.
Yeah, let me.
Because that's the issue I had.
Okay.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, we can.
Got me now? Oh my gosh. Strange, weird microphone situation. Okay.
No worries.
Good. All right. Gosh, we've had some troubles today. Anyway, let's see. Do I have control? There we go. Is that me? Okay. Anyway, we as regulators, need this document too, so that we don't fall into the old ways of the linear thinking. And that's another benefit of presenting this optimization document via the web and ITRC, is to expose the states to this iterative, interactive way of thinking and design. As you can see from this key graphic, EPA recognized the need for an adaptive management style for their Superfund projects. This figure modified from that memo clearly shows an iterative process similar to the key graphic of this document. And we as regulators, and even though that the remedial actions may occur in situ or like underground or on private property, the activities are noticed by people living and working in the surrounding communities. They want to know what activity might be affecting their lives. So honest and upfront communications can go a long way to alleviate the fear of the unknown. And it may also reveal potential consequences that were not previously thought of. It's important to develop a media communications plan, identifying a single point of contact. anticipate questions in advance and develop fact sheets as a list and a list of frequently asked questions, and then to develop that for each site. Okay. So, as you gathered from taking this course today, we want you to use this document. You've been exposed to several of the fact sheets, the tables, the table 1-1 that I told you to use as your personalized table of contents. It's web-based, so I want you to, as soon as we finish this webinar and after the question and answer period, which is next, I want you to go to the guidance document on the web and upload the Appendix F checklist to begin using everything you've learned today. Okay, Devin? Our last question and answer series, I think we're going to go ahead and answer these questions that people have been posting.
Yep. All right. Thank you, Chris. So we're going to jump right into our last question and answer portion of the training today, and then we will close out the training with a few just logistics. So our first question in the chat here, and before I answer, I would just like to remind everybody, if you have a question that you would like our trainers to address, just pop that in the Q&A chat and we will get to it. So our first question, how do you mitigate the oxidation of chromium if it is determined to be an issue while monitoring the progress of the remedy? Can you provide options?
Yeah, I think that's an excellent question. This is Rich DeRoche with GZA. I'm assuming this is a mixed plume that has both VOCs and chromium in it, that you're trying to oxidize the VOCs at the same time trying to remediate the chromium. We've had a similar situation that I've worked in. And what we try to do is we use reductive to reduce the chromium using like a sodium lactate. And then we also use iron in terms of enhancing the degradation of the VOCs. So that combination allowed us to maintain the hexavalent chromium or chrome 3, whichever you're trying to remediate, such that we were able to get it down to chrome oxide and at the same time address the VOC. So it's sort of an interesting question. You really need to look at your chemistry, look at the aquifer, look at what the oxidation potential is on that. If you remember the slides that we had where you need to look at the geochemistry, look at the geology, and really fine tune your injection, because you don't want to have such a strong oxidation that you reconvert your chromium into something else that you don't want to have, and have, as Chris pointed out, a regulatory issue at your hand that you have to address as well. And maybe somebody else may have a comment on that as well.
All right. Thank you, Rich. So it doesn't look like we have any more questions. I will transition over to our final logistics. And if anybody, I spoke too soon, apologies. We have one more question. Do you have any advice for how to approach PCB contamination that is present in isolated pockets? Do any of our trainers have any thoughts on that question? I'd be happy to read it again if you didn't hear it.
I think it's a big question. There's maybe enough unknowns in there for us to not be sure. I think it would depend on in isolated pockets and what type of media. It tends to be hydrophobic. It doesn't tend to move very much in the groundwater. I think I'm not sure that we can answer that without a little bit more information. But there would be some potentially some good ideas on how to tackle it in the guidance document itself.
I just wanted
to let you guys know that they did clarify they're talking about within sandy soil, if that helps.
And Devin, thank you for that. And I think you're right. This is a complicated issue in terms of PCBs. But if it's such an isolated pocket and it's in a very small, because it's usually not very mobile, you may want to look at how you can complement an injection strategy and maybe look at a pump and treat to just remove that limited area of PCBs. Other areas that we've done is we've used, as you saw in the injection, but recirculation. So you could probably extract the PCBs, maybe do an injection up gradient to address the rest of the either solvents or other issues that you have within the aquifer, so that you can basically try to address things at the same time. But it is a complicated issue when dealing with PCBs.
All right. Thank you, Richard. All right. So we got a few more questions in here and then we'll wrap up the training. So from a regulator standpoint, do you have any advice on addressing issues with a contractor's modeling? For example, if the geologic assumptions are unreasonable?
I don't know that I'm going to be able to answer that one. Rich, have you had any experience with this?
Yeah, I have, Chris, and Elizabeth and Susan, you may have similar to what I'm about to say, but I think the state regulatory agencies are looking as to whether or not your injection is going to create a problem, such as a human risk, an ecological risk, if you're going to do something that's going to impact a stream or a water supply. But they do expect the consultant who's designing with the contractor who's doing the injecting to be able to come up with a usable model, the conceptual site model that's going to be used. And, you know, from the state I'm living in, they would basically agree, so long as there's no potential health or ecological issue, to move forward with the injection. And if it fails, then the consultant has to go back to their client and explain why it failed. In terms of the model itself and the assumptions. So I always like erring on the side of caution, where additional, you know, remedial design characterization is important, so that you understand your geologic assumptions, your hydrogeologic and your geochemical, so that when you do the injection, then the modeling is valid and you're going to be successful. But from a regulatory standpoint, I got a feeling that so long as you're not impacting human or ecological, regulators might allow you to move forward, even with unreasonable assumptions.
All right. Thank you, Richard. All right. So it looks like we have answered all of the questions. And I will wrap up the training for today. So I would just like to say thank you to all of our participants for joining us today, and a big thank you to our expert trainers for joining us here today. We could not have done it without either of you. I'd like to remind everybody that we would love to hear back from you today, so please be sure to fill out an online feedback form. If you did register and purchase a CEU, we ask that you do complete the feedback form as a part of the tracking of your participation with the course, so please remember to do that. You're also able to acquire a certificate of completion by completing the feedback form as well. If you need any further clarification on any questions or answers that were asked today during this training, feel free to email us at training@itrcweb.org, and we will follow up with our trainers directly. You're also welcome to follow up with our trainers directly. Their information is in their bios on the Clumen training page. Just as a reminder, we do archive all of our training classes, so if you find that you have additional time or looking for any additional training opportunities, feel free to visit the Clumen training page, their archive training page, to look at all the courses that we have there to offer. So with that, I'm going to just say thank you again, and I hope you all have a wonderful holiday season as it is around the corner. And I wish you all a great rest of your day.